Thank you for downloading this podcast from the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies. For more original Torah content, visit elmad.pardes.org.
Okay, thank you as always to the Pardes Institute, pardes.org.il, for helping make this class happen. Okay, hi everybody, good morning. So we left off still in a bit of this split screen of Jewish history, right? Constructing this parallel process of two Gemarot, right? Remember, I presented you guys the Mishnah as a portable homeland, as the sort of consolidation of a conversation, right? Just to sketch the arc of where we're going, because we have to understand the Gemara as a document today. It's a piece we haven't spoken about. Somebody asked me, too, if we could do a little bit of a geography look at the page of the Gemara, which I didn't bring Gemara down with me, but if it's appropriate, we'll sketch up a bit and give you a sense of where that comes from, although it's a much later development. It's a fair question. But in order to really grasp that, we have to remember that from the time that the sages emerge as this sort of creative minority leadership striving to guide Am Yisrael after the destruction of the Second Temple to the formation of the Mishnah, so we're talking about 70 CE and the construction of the Temple, Second Temple, to we pegged Rebbe's redaction of the Mishnah, you know, early to mid 3rd century, that's 220. I think the guy that spent so much time with history, I would remember that 3rd century, 2nd century. Always mess me up. They had parallel lived traditions. Remember, in the town of Rabbi Yossi Galilee, they ate chicken parmesan. Right? That's the way to remember it. Right? And the challenge that Rebbe faced was that so long as there was some vessel holding all these different parallel traditions together, there was still some sense of wholeness, right? The Jews of the Galil maybe looked askance at the Jews of the coast or the Jews of Yehuda, but they all saw each other as Jews. The danger is, once the people of the town of Rabbi Yossi of Galilee get pushed off to, I don't know, Hispania, the far-flung provinces of the Roman Empire, and the other Jews who don't eat chicken parmesan are back there in Bavel, what's going to happen next when they look at each other? They sit down at their meal and they say, "Would you like some chicken parmesan?" What do they say? "You're not Jews," right? And so what Rebbe did was he took these parallel lived traditions and he consolidated them into the Mishnah. But we spoke about why he maintained the minority position and the whole power of argumentation as actually the way we relate to the past, right? That we carry our tradition forward by arguing with it, that it's not a static process. And the Mishnah basically, just want you to remember, it creates that portable homeland, the place in which you can have a conversation that transcends geography and chronology. It's happening upstairs right now. Y'all can come on up if you want and learn some Mishnah. Right? So then we left off in the flow of time. There's been a lot since then. In the flow of time with Rav. That Rav was Rabbi Yehuda's student who brought the Mishnah with him down to Bavel. Right? And we even spoke a little bit about this idea that Rav Tanahu Upalig, right? That Rav may be a Tana. He might have that status of one of the masters of the Mishnah because he's able to argue on the Mishnah. Right? That's the what that phrase means. Generally, it's the way it's understood. Tana u falig, that he is a Tana and therefore he can argue, unlike the shift to the Amoraim that we discussed many times. But do you guys remember what else I told you that could mean? Anybody remember the other way you could read Tana u falig? He teaches and argues, yes. That he's not just bringing the Mishnah, he's also bringing the methodology of Gemara. Right? That already, in so many papers open here, I'm looking for it. No, come on. You know, always the one you're looking for that you can't find. But already the Gemara recognizes that in the time of Rebbe, the focus was on learning Gemara and not Mishnah. We spoke about this, that Gemara is a methodology of conversation. That the Mishnah is deliberately filled with lacuna, with empty spaces, in order to promote the process of learning and also in order to promote, as we spoke about, the maintenance of student-teacher relationship. Right? Because that critical element of the oral tradition, right? And that maintains them both. Right? The two elements of oral tradition we said that were so critical were, number one, anything truly important, you wouldn't write it down because you might forget it. Right? So therefore, if you've ever picked up a Mishnah and wanted to know what it's talking about, you've probably been frustrated at first glance because just reading it doesn't work. It's clear that there's some way in which it's meant to be learned. So therefore, there has to be a constant engagement with it. It's not enough just to write it down. And the other one was the student-teacher relationship, which allows for a live feedback, which is why, as we noted, the Gemara is full of instances where two students will claim to have different teachings in the name of the same teacher. And that may sound bizarre. It may sound like an excuse for a printer's error. But I can tell you as a teacher, I know for a fact that not everyone in this room is hearing the same thing right now. And even if the same words are bouncing off of yours, I promise you don't understand it the same. And that's a fascinating element of human experience that the postmodern era has only begun to delve into in terms of how you educate. Consciously knowing that what I'm saying right now has less to do with what's coming out of my mouth than it has to do with what's going to your ears. Yeah, because the human brain is a filter. It's not a sponge. Right? And so therefore, I cannot in any way assume that just because I'm absolutely clear on what I'm saying and what my intention is and what I'm doing here, that that is what you're absorbing. So therefore, the interaction is a critical element of education. And that also, by the way, leads to the fact that the sages recognize that who were their great teachers? They learned a lot from their teachers, much from their colleagues, but most from their students. It's because of that phenomenon. It's not just like a cheesy catchphrase to make students feel good while teachers make big bucks. Right? It's because in order to educate, the student is the primary medium and not the teacher. And I want to emphasize that because we're going to really build that as the theme of what the Gemara is. I'm going to say it again. The difference in my mind between a teacher and an educator is that for a teacher, the content is primary. Right? I have material that I want to present to you, and that's it. The best situation is that you're a blank slate. This is a whole model of teaching. I'm just going to pour my knowledge into you. That's a healthy teacher. An unhealthy teacher, it's actually about the teacher, but we'll ignore that situation. That's a teacher, so the primary medium of teaching is the content. For an educator, the primary medium is the student. Right? Meaning the actual content of what I'm teaching becomes secondary. I'm trying to create a learner. I'm trying to uncover, right? That's why there's that beautiful quote by Michelangelo that he said that I saw the angel in the marble and I carved to set him free, right? That's the educational approach, is that when I look at a student, I think, okay, the material that we're learning is an opportunity to evoke something, to set something free, to train, but that the material is secondary. And as we're going to see, the Gemara as a conversation depends on creating the voices that will carry it forward. So that's the sort of overarching picture we're going to delve in today. Just to finish the brief review. Yeah, Avram. Yes. Absolutely. They're just different. They're different modes. Listen, I don't know that the average physics teacher, at the beginning stages, there's a tremendous amount of knowledge you need. In the same way, language, there are tools of discourse that you must have in order to have an intelligent conversation. But physics, I saw some surprised look. But physics, to really understand it, I have to actually understand who you are and how your mind works, and I have to evoke within you the desire.
An educator should be using different techniques with different kinds of students.
That's one of the hallmarks.
If you teach Mishnah to some clever 10 or 11 years old, you would have a different technique than you.
Absolutely, and that's one of the hallmarks of an educator as opposed to a teacher, because the necessity of using multiple methods of education is because of the recognition that there are different types of students. As opposed to the material's always the same. Like you said, the Mishnah doesn't change. The people teaching, the people learning do. Okay. So just to finish the brief review, in Eretz Yisrael, we trace out a sort of a somewhat sketch of a line of the process of the formation of the Yerushalmi, of the Palestinian Talmud. And we said it got cut off round about the same time that the institution of the Sanhedrin came to an end, and we're putting it around 425, right? That date is because when Rabban Gamliel VI dies, that's when the emperor declines to renew the tax of the patriarch. I mean, trust me, he kept taxing the Jews, but the tax went straight to the emperor as opposed to the institution of the patriarchate, and that's where we can locate in the non-Jewish sources the official end of any sort of central political body for the Jews in the land of Israel. Now, we're going to come back to that time period again today when we finally touch on Christianity. Please God, we're going to get there. But that kind of brings to an end a certain arc of story in the land of Israel. It's not going to go away. We're going to see the Persian come back, and you know, the land of Israel will always hold a certain ideological centrality, if not actual physical centrality for the story. But the process of the dispersion has reached a new level once there's no recognizable political body of Jews in the land of Israel. You understand what I'm saying? There will be Jews there, but they will be completely subsumed within the Roman and then the Persian and then the Muslim Islamic empires. They won't have their own status, per se, in the land of Israel. And then we spent sort of the last third of class last week speaking out the line of Babylon. All right? You guys remember why God sent the Jews into exile in Babylon in the first temple? What was the reason we said? We sent back to their mother's house, right? Going home, and we saw that there's a bunch of very evocative Gemaras. It's going home. They have the same language. It's when a husband's angry with his wife, he sends her back to his father's house. It has a lot to do with the relationship between God and Israel, but also the recognition that, you know, Abraham came from Ur Kasdim, that there's some roots of the Jewish people, linguistically and culturally, that work very well in Babel. Now, I don't know how much the sages looked at that in terms of the Western model of history, right? Sort of a documentary exposure to the historicity of these things. But you know what they knew very well is that there was a cultural compatibility, right? Compatibility, right? You guys, several people asked me, like, what kind of evidence do we have about the Jewish community basically from, let's say, the fall of the Second Temple, first century of the Common Era, up until we have suddenly these academies and you read the Gemara and it seems like there's all these Jews. So I did more research, because I told you guys not much. I did more research over the last week, and guess what? I was right, there's not much. But I did find a little bit more. By the way, if you're interested, Professor Yeshayahu Gafni, who's here at the Hebrew University and happens to be a very nice man, I've approached him before, he's extraordinarily helpful, is one of the world experts on that. So if you ever want to try to grab him in the street, if you recognize him, he's kind of a short, smiley guy. What's that? Is he lecturing here this year? Oh, there you go. And an advertisement for upcoming programs. He's lecturing here in January. He's an excellent speaker, and he is one of the world's experts on this question. So his contention is that the only real documentation we have of this period is in the Gemara, in which case seeing is in the Gemara itself. So seeing as, and we have fragmentary pieces here and there, but seeing as the Gemara is, as I've made the assertion multiple times, not interested in the Western model of history, even if it's aware of it, but it's interested in the narrative model. Just to remind you guys, I'm going to keep quizzing you. What's the difference between the Western model of history and the narrative model? The secret is the Jews don't care about the past. They care about the future. Yeah, I know it's strange because we're telling our story of the past all the time. But I'll just remind you, that model, just like, you know, you remember that Rabbi Gosi Galili ate chicken parmesan. Remember, where do the Jews revisit our history in the most powerful fashion? What day of the year? Pesach, and who are you telling that story to? Your children. Right? It's not an act of nostalgic recollection. It's an act of setting the future on the right track by knowing what the past was, and by knowing how to tell the story of the past in a way in which will bring you to the future that you want. If you really want evidence, and then I'll go back to focus, I bet you guys in your house have a few Haggadot. I'm guessing, right? Go look at the graphic representation of the four sons in the Haggadah. And you'll get a stark example of how really this is a story about what you want your children to be like and not about what happened in Egypt, you know, some thousands of years ago. If you guys know, I see some people nodding, like some Haggadot are like completely shameless. They're like, what does the wicked son look like? What does the righteous son look like? You know, those are the two giveaways. Anyway, So the Gemara presents what's happening in Babel, as we said, as Rav found an open field and fenced it in. And that's where we left it off, right? Rav comes down with the Mishnah. He's the student of Rebbe. Rebbe didn't give him smicha because Rebbe wanted to keep that authority within the land of Israel. So Rav goes down in approximately the year 230 or 219, depending on, according to Rav Shrera, it's 219. According to the secular historians, it's 230. I don't remember which one I put on your... I put 230 there. Why do I always listen to the secular historians? He meets in Babel Shmuel. Right? Rav and Shmuel in the Gemara are like always going toe-to-toe, even though likely a lot of those conversations didn't happen face-to-face. Nevertheless, they hold a parallel position. Right? Shmuel was in Nahardia, which at the time was the sort of original center of Torah in Babel. Shmuel had also learned in Eretz Yisrael. What's clear from the evidence we have is even though there was a culture of learning in Bavel at this point, and now we're talking about the early 3rd century, that its roots were still in the land of Israel. You understand? That the great sages of Bavel at this point had all learned in Israel and brought their Torah back. That will shift soon. Uh-huh. Do we know with whom Shmuel studied? The Gemara says that Shmuel came up and studied with Rebbe. Right? In fact, he was famously, he cured Rebbe Yehuda Anasi. He cured Rebbe Yehuda Anasi for some eye disease I have here written down. And, you know, what's that? He studied in the land of Israel, yes. And Shmuel taught us two very important lessons, which we have to reiterate. One, we spoke about at length last class, I'm not going to go back into it, which is Dina de Malchuta Dina, this idea that the law of the kingdom is indeed law, right? That you might be violating the Torah if you cross against the red light, in addition to taking your life in your hands. So that is a completely different relationship between the Jews of Bavel and the Jews of Rome. Remember, that the Jews of the land of Israel, sorry. Under Roman rule and then Christian rule, there will be a rebellious attitude. Number one, because the Romans are occupiers in our land, and that the Reish Lakish banditry spirit of the Maccabees that we spoke about will always be bubbling under the surface. The other is that Christianity, as we'll speak about today, engages in direct theological battle with the Jews. So therefore, there is no real making peace with medieval Christianity. I don't think that is reflective of today's situation, but it bears some thought on how that shift happened. Right? You understand? So in the land of Israel, it's conflict-oriented. Nobody's praying for the peace of Rome. Right? Whereas in Bavel, Dina de Malchuta Dina is rooted in those words of Jeremiah that we spoke out last week, that you should pray for the peace of the city in which you find yourselves. Right? And that will create the model of exile which will carry the Jews all over the world. Right? The Jews are loyal citizens. Right? The Jews are supporters of state, and as we spoke about, supporters of absolute power in particular, because the stability it offers is always good news for the Jews in the short term. So the other thing that Shmuel taught that I wanted to touch on before we just continue and finish off the story of Bavel is Shmuel is the bearer of one of the most important opinions on the messianic vision, which I think relates directly to his notion of Dina de Malchuta Dina. Right, there's an argument in the Gemara between Shmuel and Rav Huna, I mean they didn't actually meet, but meaning two opinions, which is that when you read the verses in Isaiah, right, this the lion shall lay down with the lamb, and the child will play at the viper's nest, and right, no one shall harm each other on my holy mountain. Is that talking about the time of the Messiah? Or is that talking about Olam Haba, some sort of like existentially separate existence? It's an argument, right? And Rav Huna says that that's speaking about the Messianic era, that somehow nature will change and that the world as we know it will no longer be the world. And Shmuel says a very important phrase, Ein bein yemot ha-Mashiach v'yemot ha-Ela, ela shibud malchuyo bilvad. There's no difference between the Messianic era and our time other than the subjugation to the nations. Which the Rambam paskins l'alacha. Rambam paskins like Shmuel. Yes, there is no distinction between the Messianic era and our own, except our subjugation to the nations. Shmuel says that. The meaning, in our time, says Shmuel, we're subjugated by the nations. In the time of the Messiah, we'll be free. It's a socio-political vision of Messianic era. There won't be any difference in nature, according to Shmuel, not in the time. Maybe in Olam Haba, in some sort of later stage, which if you've even taken a cursory glance at the Jewish sources, it's a mess. Gan Eden, Olam Haba, Mashiach, Tchiyat HaMeitim, take your pick. Doesn't really matter. But the critical piece here is that Shmuel has a socio-political vision of the future, not what we would call it classically eschatological. Right? It's not a shift of world at the end of days. It's an end to exile. Now, this has all kinds of implications, not the least of which, if you think about it, you understand, if you hadn't thought about it before, the sort of driving force of the messianic element in religious Zionism, which is if you have a strong opinion in the Gemara that says the only qualifying factor for the days of the Messiah is freedom from the nations, which is brought l'halacha as Jewish law by the Rambam, who's a big voice, well then, by definition, you live in the era of the Messiah. Well, we're almost there. Because, you know, the question of what's Shibud Malchuyot, you know, it's a tough question. But you understand, not only that, but it's actionable. You can define it. I mean, if you ever read those paragraphs in Isaiah, it's kind of like, that's beautiful, it's great, but what does that have to do to me? Like, how am I supposed to bring about the lion and the lamb laying down together, right? Which will be a great challenge, by the way, for the rabbinic authorities that pursue that path. How do we actually have an aspiration for Messiah, which is actionable? But for Shmuel, oddly enough, he has together this notion of the law of the land is the law. We accept the kingdom within which we live, but we define our exile by the fact that there is a kingdom under which we are subjects. And so therefore, our aspiration is actually the Bar Kokhba path, if you recall, which is all you got to do is throw off the Romans, and by definition, that's the Messiah. Yeah, although once you make it a sociopolitical definition, it opens the door a lot more easily to a self-help attitude, right? And we will trace this, right? The role of messianism is a very important role in the arc of Jewish history. People are interested, by the way. Gershom Scholem has a fairly foundational essay on the topic of what it is to have hope and what it is to have fervor. That basically the messianic element is the yeast in the bread that keeps Am Yisrael as like a thriving, growing culture. Hope is the most precious commodity. You cannot live without it. At the same time, he traces throughout history the sense that when things get bad enough, you know what happens to that hope? It becomes expectation. And what happens when your expectations aren't met? Disappointment, right? It's shattering. And so therefore, you can see through Jewish history that there are times when the messianic hope turns into a fervent expectation, which brings tremendous energy to bear, but often leads to an implosion, which is one of the reasons that there was so much hesitation around the Zionist movement in its day. So Shmuel is sitting there in Bavel, thinking these thoughts, and he has a very close relationship with the king, Shapur Malcha, and who shows up at his doorstep? Rav. Right? We said Rav was too smart to try to sort of, everybody knew Rav was the big student of Rabbi Yehuda Nasi, never left. Rav got out of town. He didn't want to stay around in Nardia, right, because he didn't want to step on anybody's toes, etc. He's a very, very humble and understanding politician. So he moves to Sura, right? In Sura, we said that he found an open field and he fenced it in. And you guys remember the Gemara example I gave you guys, that he heard two Jewish maidservants overheard them speaking, "How much milk do you need to cook, you know, 2 kilo of beef?" And he said, "What? What's going on here?" Right? And we raised this question. What did it mean that these people were Jews? If they were not speaking Hebrew, they weren't keeping in any respect rabbinic law, and one could make an argument that their grasp on Torah law was, let's just say, imperfect if they're eating milk and meat together. Right? What did it mean? Do you guys remember the answer I gave you? Brighton Beach Judaism. For those who aren't American, I apologize. You guys ever been to Brighton Beach? Right? What makes a Jew in Brighton Beach? And actually, I'm talking about a past era, right? What? Meaning everybody's Jewish. Everybody's Jewish. The bus driver's Jewish. The guy in the store is Jewish. What do you mean? Why am I Jewish? I'm Jewish. That's what I am, right? There's a power of cultural continuity which is held by geographic concentration. That's the best answer I can give you. What did it mean that the Jews in Bavel were Jewish? That's what they were. And they were that because they looked to their neighbors and their friends and the guy in Makola down the street, and that's what everybody was.
Is it definition by the outside? Like in Germany?
So it's a good question. It seems that it was the Parthian and then the Sassanid. Persian is just a blanket empire. We'll just call them Persians. There's no reason to get into all the various eras. The Persians ran a similar model in that they liked communal integrity. They didn't want to deal with individuals. It wasn't the Roman citizenship model, right? It was a model of what we call corporate existence, not with suit and tie, but rather there's this entity called the Jews, and they have their own laws, they have their own courts, they have their own social fabric, they pay the taxes as a whole, and we'd rather they administer themselves, right? I pointed out to you that there's a hint of this already in the beginning of the Megillah and the idea that Ahasuerus ruled over 127 kingdoms and that you get everybody in their own language and everybody in their own rules. So, like, you get the sense that the Eastern empires were amalgamations, right? And so we're going to see that this will pop up into an independent Jewish commonwealth for 7 years in the midst of the Persian Empire by the end of our story today. So Rav founds Sura. Now, I say founds, right? We have this image of these academies, and I don't know how you picture it, but often I think people picture like modern-day really big yeshivas. If you've ever been to the Mir or Lakewood, right, these really big yeshivas, that must be what it looked like, which is fine, and I think Moshe probably wore a strimal at Mount Sinai. But what's important to me that you understand is that this is a process of evolution. And since the Gemara itself, its final editing is around the year 500-600, we're getting a back projection. I mean, by 500-600, there were academies, likely large buildings, students who sat permanently along with a rhythm of the Arche Kala that we'll explain momentarily, right? And so therefore, there were institutions in the modern sense, right? What it seems to be in the origins, that was not the case. These were leaders, Torah leaders, teachers, who gathered around them schools of thought, as opposed to true institutions, which meant that they would come and go, depending on, right, when such people held sway. But nevertheless, the roots of what became the dual academy structure, Nardia, even though it's the oldest, gets destroyed in the 3rd century by one of the last Roman pushes into Parthia. I don't remember if I wrote that down on your timeline. It's around 259, if I'm not mistaken. I'm sure if I... perfect. Lucius Septimus Odenatus in 259 destroys Nardia. And that's when Pumpedita replaces it, and the academies of Sura and Pumpedita, at least in name, if not in physical location, will follow us all the way down through the Gaonic era. And now we have these two academies, and what happens in an academy? Right, they have the Mishnah, which is the core of their conversation, and what they're doing is they are discoursing. They're talking. Remember, that's that model I told you, that if you have friends for over 10 years, you've been having the same conversations repeatedly and building on top of them. You build a shared language, conceptual framework that doesn't just allow you not to waste your time by repeating things, but allows you to deepen your understanding. Right? And this is what's happening, but it is oral. It is an oral culture, according to almost every opinion. That the Gemara, like the Mishnah, begins as oral text, and there's an open question at what point it ever gets written down. We'll look at some of that as we go forward.
Didn't you say last week that Rabbi Levine Hanan said that Rabbi Levine Hanan was the that he knew that it was wrong to write it down?
Yes.
But they did anyway?
Well, what we said, there's nowhere in the Gemara that it says that Rabbi Hanasi wrote down the Mishnah. We said that Kotev Halacho Kesorev HaTorah. I brought you guys the Gemara from Temura that says anybody who writes down Halacha is like one who burns the Torah. And since, according to some Rishonim, Rebbe did actually write it down, right? And according to everyone, in the end of the day, it led to it being written down. So we explored this problem of how could he do such a thing that he knew was a violation of the Torah itself. It wasn't just wrong. It was the Torah. It was a violation of a Torah prohibition of writing it down. Yeah, so the question of when it actually gets written down is just, it's a wide open debate amongst academics and the scholars. My suspicion, just from the little I know of orality and culture, is that it's unlikely it would have been written down. The primary texts were oral.
In any case, assuming that the Mishnah is, if you like, an aid memoir, something to remind you of what the whole subject is about.
Right, a mnemonic device.
A mnemonic device, an aid memoir to aid.
Yeah. So good. We could take a middle position, right? That if the Mishnah itself was not an end unto itself, but it was rather a tool to aid the process, so then it's not the same as writing it down. Okay, great. I mean, there's a lot to explore in that, but I want to keep us moving in the story of Bavel because we got to get to Gemara. Otherwise, you guys are going to stop showing up and repeat the same piece of history for the entire semester. So just to trace out the rest of the arc of Rav's. It's at the end of Rav's era that the phenomenon of Yarche Kala emerges. We have these two academies, and it's important to remember that the culture of learning, which becomes central to Am Yisrael, takes a lot of work to get off the ground. And it's not obvious to anyone that learning is a critical act of of cultural continuity or social construction. Even though post facto, at this point in the Jewish world, it's a given. Even then, by the way, right? I'm sure we could agree on this. It's still a hard sell to a lot of people who are devoted to Jewish continuity and Jewish culture, et cetera. The hours, I used to be part of a collective men's, working men's yeshiva. And so as a collective, we paid all our bills together, et cetera. And we had a rule that anybody who couldn't pay had to pay back in butt hours. Right? How many hours a week will you be found in that seat right there? Because if you can't actually pay tuition, we're willing to give you a discount if you're willing to up your hours. Why? Because that's all it takes. That's why they call it a yeshiva. It's a sittery. It's a sittery. And I tell my students this all the time, and I'm telling you, it's a tough sell in a culture which is all about speed and convenience to say that there is no way around the fact that if you want to understand this, you need to do it over and over and over again for an entire year. There's no way around it. Because remember, what was that central message of the method of Mishnah, remember? What did Mishnah mean? It means to teach, but it also means what? Repetition. And the place where they met was that notion of shinun, that sharpening of the knife. Right? The Mishnah is not so much about acquiring information as it is about creating a voice in a conversation that you internalize. In the same way we spoke about tefillah as a narrative method of doing the same thing. You install a story that allows a person to live in that story. And so the Yarchei Kala phenomenon was a way in which the small core of devoted students that had gathered around Rav or Shmuel or the later personalities would be enhanced twice a year in the months of Elul and Adar by a much larger segment of the population. Now, let's see how much you can think about late antiquity. Why Elul and Adar? Yeah. What's happening in those 2 months? It's the downtime of the agriculture, right? In Elul, it's the end of summer. There ain't nothing to be done. The ground's too hard to plow. The harvest is well done and is drying in the fields, right? And you're basically in between. Adar, in the same way, it's the depth of winter, right? It's cold, rainy. You're not yet plowing for the spring crops, right? There's an added benefit, aside from the agricultural rhythm, what's the sort of in the Jewish calendar religious rhythm, what do Elul and Adar offer if you're going to gather a large part of the male population of a certain age together to the Yarchei Kala? What do you focus on? Right, the Chagei Tishrei and Pesach. I mean, this is a way you can give people not only learning, but of instruction, right? Because there's a lot. I don't know if you guys ever get mitzvah stress, right? But you know, like Elul, it's like, oh my gosh, I'll get it. The shofar and the lulav and the sukkah and the, you know, and of course the whole liturgy and you know, Pesach. And my gosh, like, you can write whole books on Pesach, right? People do that, right? So the power of that rhythm is established by the Yarchei Kala. Apparently, it was so prevalent in Bavel that the Gemara records that in the time of Rava, who we're going to say he dies around. Who I wrote it in my notes. He dies in around 352. He was accused of actually reducing the king's revenue because the Jews would just abandon their fields twice a year and all crowd into the academies.
So we can deduce from this, of course, that Jews were allowed to own land, or at least work land.
There's no question that the whole context of the Babylonian Gemara shows that the Jews were an agricultural people. I mean, also commercial, but...
Right, so, but later on, when this was not the case, at least in Europe, they became craftsmen and so on.
We'll speak about what happens when the Jews are completely detached from the land. You're correct. But one of the reasons that Babylonian culture often is experienced when you read the Gemara as almost a seamless flow from the land of Israel is that there was a maintenance of the agricultural base to culture, right? Remember, Josephus says in the Second Temple of Times, the Jews are an agricultural people. Commerce is foreign to them. This sounds like a very strange comment, right? But it's a big shift that happens. Yarchei Kala are the moons. Yerech is the moon. Kala, I'm not actually sure what it means in that context. I'll look it up for you.
Okay.
I don't know who started it. It starts with the arrival of the culture of the Mishnah into Bavel. And again, what I want you to think about it is that as we spoke about, Rabbinic Judaism doesn't just pop up overnight and become definitive of what Judaism is. Right? There's a constant, consistent effort from the time that Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai escapes Jerusalem to Yavne to say, we need to create a new model. Right? And what's the goal? I told you guys, the identification between what and what? The one-to-one identification between? I'll sharpen it for you. Between law and identity. That a Jew is what a Jew does. Right? And the sages, consciously or unconsciously, are pushing out any model that would allow you to say, yeah, I'm a Jew, but I eat chicken parmesan. Because the answer to that is, well, no, you're not. Except, of course, you know, a person, we all have our weaknesses. But if you're familiar with the discourse, there's a very big difference of how we treat a Jew who eats chicken parmesan because, gosh, I was just walking by and it looks so good, to the person who says, no, I eat chicken parmesan. And what are you going to do about it, right? Because the sages will do what to that second person? Well, they'll describe him as a mumar, as a person who basically has stepped out of the community. And depending on what it is you do, if you violate Shabbat in public, you may have all the halachic definitions of Jews. We won't count you in a minyan, we won't drink your wine. You know, so yeah, so you see these boundaries are quite powerful, as we're going to see going forward through time, in keeping a social definition. Yeah, Shelley. Were the Jews permitted to own the land? As far as I know, yes. I say as far as I know because my knowledge based on this question primarily comes from the Gemara, and certainly the language of the Gemara is talking about kinyan, it's talking about selling and buying, etc. As far as I know, the development of the forbidden nature of Jewish ownership of land has to do with a particular European Christian culture. Even in Spain, the Jews owned huge portions of both in Muslim and Christian Spain, huge amounts of land. That's why they lost so much money during the expulsion. So we're tracing the arc of the development of the culture which eventually produces the Gemara. So the next real turning point, so we have these, let's call them proto-academies, right? Gathered around teachers, right? The core students and this sort of like annual influx, which is creating a whole culture of learning. And notice it does two things. Well, three. One, it drills the rhythm of the Hebrew calendar into daily life in a way which might have been lost. Right? Number two, it creates a culture of learning which flows out from the academies, right? I mean, even though you don't actually sit in the academy, the Arche Kala are definitive experiences. Just think about the power. By the way, what's it evoking also? In that sense of all the Jews coming together in one place to see and be seen? Yeah, that experience of Hamune Am, of the masses of people who come together at the temple, even though it's not on the exact same rhythm, it's still, that's a very important experience. Anybody who's ever, any sports fans out there? Yeah. Right? You ever go to a game for your team? Yeah. Right? It feels very different to be part of a rooting for team when you're surrounded by 30,000 people who are on your side. Right? So it's especially if you're a Red Sox fan, what? And the third piece, and don't miss this one, it elevates the status of the students. Because, you know, I may show up as a farmer twice a year and sort of drink from the wells of Torah and get what I can, but I have an experience. If I get there, who's already there? The core students. And when I leave, who stays? The core students. So if you're able to enforce in my mind that the real value of life is there, then who are the truly powerful people in my society? Right? This becomes formative for Jewish life up until modernity. What was number two? Oh, you want me to go backwards? Oh, that experience of the masses of people coming together and in a sense of us, of a team, which revolves again around Torah learning. So the next sort of important shift, and obviously I'm not going to drag you through every generation of the Amoraim. The next important shift comes around the time of Abai and Rava, whose names probably of all the sages of the Gemara are probably the most familiar, and so much so that the Gemara is often referred to as Havayot Shel Abai and Rava, right? The thoughts or the experiences, the musings of Abai and Rava. So, fourth century, more or less, we're going to say the Abai dies around 339 and Rava dies at 352. Those are the numbers that I have here, but I warned you about these numbers because Rav Shvira Gaon and the traditional dating is very different than the academic dating, but plus minus a decade. But why is this an important period? Because at this point in the mid-4th century, life in the land of Israel got really, really rough. for reasons that we will speak of when we get to the Christian narrative. And there was an influx of Amoraim from Eretz Israel. If you've ever experienced in the Gemara, right, Ki'ata Ravin, Ki'ata Ravdimi, right? When Ravin came, when Ravdimi came, and it's like, well, what do you mean when they came? First of all, where'd they come from? Always Rashi makes it very clear, came from the land of Israel, right? And Ki, that's like when they came. It's the same way that outsider doesn't understand what you're talking about. But if you and I have been having a conversation for 10 years and I say, you know, when Johnny got out of school, well, you know exactly what I'm talking about, in theory, right? Right? Because we share a narrative. So that experience of this influx of the Amoraim from the land of Israel is marked in the Gemara. And according to many of the scholars, this is when the sugyot of the Gemara began to form. Like, what is a sugya? It's a conceptual frame. Right? This is these pieces of the conversation that we've been having for 20, 30 years that have now reached enough clarity that I can use them to build on. So language works the same way, right? We talk about a fence. No, let's use something more specific. Let's talk about the Reshut HaRabim. You guys know what Reshut HaRabim is? Reshut HaRabim is public space. Now, you get this question of what you can do in the Reshut HaRabim. It's a question that the mission in Bava Metzia deals with a lot, and comes up, obviously, in discussion in the Gemara. And it's always a question. If I'm walking my cow through the Reshut HaRabim, and you leave your, I don't know, your clay jug of grain in the middle of the Reshut HaRabim, and I pause to look at some dates, and my cow says, ooh, and eats it, who's liable? Right? So the concept of Reshut HaRabim needs some clarification. By the way, it's very interesting, if you ever learn the Gemara, that in Eretz Yisrael, you guys ever been to the Cardo in the Old City? The Reshut HaRabim was like the Cardo. It was a Roman construct that was basically a thoroughfare with shops on the sides. In Bavel, Reshut HaRabim and the cities of Bavel were far more city squares. And if you look closely at a lot of the argumentations of the Gemara, you can make a good pitch that a lot of the difficulties in the sugyot have to do with the fact that we don't actually share the definition. If I stop my cow in the middle of the thoroughfare, it's very different than if I stop my cow in the middle of the town square, right? The primary difference being, like, I stop in the middle of town square, okay, the people are going every which way. In the thoroughfare, it's like, no, we're moving through here, people. Right? But the idea is that once you know what a Reshut HaRabim is, and we've worked out all the ramifications of what happens if I stop my cow, what happens if I drop my purse, what happens if I, et cetera, et cetera, then I can just use this phrase, Reshut HaRabim, and we can build on it. You know, when what happens at Tzideh Reshut HaRabim? What about those sides there where technically it's part of the same space but nobody hangs out? Or like when you're in the Shuk, where the place where it's legitimate to pull it aside, put your backpack down and stuff, and nobody's going to like hip check you, right? Or if they do, you're actually going to get angry, as opposed to if you do it in the middle where they're going to say to you, Nudnik, it's the Shuk. Why'd you stop in the middle? No, that's a real life example. You guys understand what I'm saying? That this process of the sugyot, of taking these conceptual frames and locking them in and allowing us to make sure that we're having the same conversation, as far as we can tell, begin around the early to mid 4th century under Abaye and Rava, when there's this influx of Amoraim from Eretz Israel. Interestingly enough, because of the historical sociological circumstance of how hard life got. Right? So that leads over the next, we'll call it 100 to 150 years, to a consolidation of this thing we know as the Gemara. Yeah, Chuck. They were Bavlim. Unless I'm entirely mistaken. I don't think so. In my notes, I have them as Bavlim. So the real question is, ongoing conversation, it can go forever, right? And you guys have probably noticed this about Jewish texts, right? But we made this reference to the process of codification last week, and we didn't come back to it. You know, what does codification actually mean? Well, that's the challenge. That's an implication that the conversation's over. But what does codification actually mean? There's a narrowing down of ambiguities. There's a making of more precise. perforce, that means that there's a discarding of some certain amounts of materials. There's a systematizing, right? What used to be an organic, somewhat messy process. There's always a structure, which helps enormously. That's the sugyot. Even though people often experience the Bavli as winding, it has very clear structures. It's also, at a certain point, the conversation has to have a point. I want to know. We've been talking about this for 200 years. Am I allowed to stop my cow in the middle or not? Right?
Yes, I was going to say, it creates the boundary of what is okay and what is not.
So the elements of structure and the elements of defining, be it terms or law, are, I would say, the two critical pieces that I want to take out of this. Right? The elements of structure. I mean, the structure has to do with the clarification and the refining the points, but it also has to do with the fact that this is not just a random conversation. It's a conversation about practical questions. Don't forget that the rabbinic project is driven by this notion that God cares about everything and that we can know what God thinks about anything. Those two pieces are driving this conversation. I'm going to say it again. God cares about everything, and that the human mind can know what God thinks about everything. So therefore, we no longer need this sort of prophetic tradition to tell us what to do. We have a process that will allow us to apply to every question. Right? Just remember, and all these, like the chicken parmesan example, etc., Rav Moshe Feinstein, in the early 20th century, 1930s, actually 1950s, was mid-20th century, told the world what God thinks about the microwave. Right? Because nobody knew. If you take a piece of salami and you put it in a cup of milk and you put it in the microwave on high for 2 minutes, is that a violation of a Torah prohibition or a violation of a rabbinic prohibition? So he said it was a violation of a Torah-level prohibition. That's another way of saying that God doesn't want you to cook salami and milk in your microwave. Right? And that's in the 20th century. So the Gemara is premised on this idea that God cares about everything, and that the human mind can actually know what God thinks about any particular question. And that bringing structure to the conversation and definitive psak, as we spoke about, the stopping of that process, leads us to the question of what Abraham said. Is that an end to the conversation? I want you to hold that question because we're going to come back to it. Right? So practically speaking, but legalizing in the sense of we make a decision, this is permitted, that it's forbidden, or there's a clarification, this is relevant material, this is not. I mean, law, which, as we'll speak about probably next week, is a rising tide in the world as a whole at this point in history, the rise of legal culture, right? Law is about defining status and power relationships, right? And the Gemara will do plenty of that, but it's also interested in a lot of other things. So that's what I want to finish here now. We're going to actually finish the story of Gemara. We're going to talk about Christianity. It's all going to happen, I promise you. Just not necessarily today. Yes, Steve.
So you said these two things about the rabbinic agenda, which is that God knows and cares about everything we do.
Yeah, although I want to challenge the word agenda. It was a deep-seated belief. It's true. It became a political, social agenda.
Deep-seated belief, and then also that men had the humans of it, and things like that.
Mm-hmm. Although I wouldn't hesitate on use of man. I think that they did believe that. We look at it perhaps differently today, but don't shy away from the fact that that's how they looked at it.
Is this this idea, this two-part idea, about understanding rabbinic culture, is this statement something that comes from later on and looking at the total, are the rabbis self-conscious of this and are there places where they actually describe themselves as having?
It's a great question. Does this perspective, a post facto, here's the Gemara, now we understand what they were doing, or was it in real time, were they aware of that? I would say it's a bit of both. The evidence that post facto is easy, because we look at what they were doing. The greatest piece of evidence I could show you from within is the fact that it will come out fairly often in the Gemara. When two Omoraim are arguing about a point of law, and one will bring a verse saying, "Oh, this is the proof text." The Gemara will often answer, "Lama likra svarahi? Why do I need a verse when I can figure this out from svara, from logic?" Meaning the sages are operating on the assumption that properly used, the human, intellect can express the divine. Right? And so that you see from where they poured their energy that this was the project. And it's consistent if you think back, you were in class last year. We've spoken a little bit about this vision of Daniel and the removal of Malchut, of the kingdom of God, from the external expressions of kings and their wars and political structures, and by the way, the temple and prophets, right? And the moving of that to a kingdom within. And if you guys recall, that got a little edgy when we spoke about Christianity, because it sounds to most Jews like a very Christian language when you speak about the kingdom of God is within. But this is precisely what the sages are doing, because now if you want to live in the kingdom of God, you can do it anywhere. Why? Because it depends on what you eat, how you talk, who you interact with, what day in the calendar it is, and what that asks of you, how you pray, who you pray with, which shoe you put on first. You understand? I can take the kingdom of God anywhere. And the question will be, at what point does the false construct around me crumble and suddenly the whole world is living in the kingdom of God? Think of Natan Sharansky sitting in prison in the Soviet Union. Right, there's a famous story he tells that he told a joke to one of his guards, and he laughed. You could see the guard struggling not to laugh, and he said, "Who's in prison, you or I?" Right, but really the message there is Natan Sharansky believed in where he belonged and who he was. And what happened? His belief in that kingdom was so powerful that the world that imprisoned him crumbled around him. And where are they now? You know, and in the same way, when Shmuel said there's no difference between our world and the Messianic era other than the subjugation of the nations, he was not a Zionist in the sense that what that means is to have an army and a Knesset, etc. He might have agreed, but his primary goal was that we're able to practice the Torah in its fullness with freedom. So therefore, until such time, we're gonna move that kingdom within. But we have a belief that, be it through our actions or through external actions, that world which is oppressing us will crumble. It's interesting, and probably not this year, but maybe next, when we get to modernity, we'll speak about, well, how come when the gates of the ghetto opened up, most people chucked their tefillin in the river and went to medical school? It didn't really work out that way, which is a deep challenge that Orthodoxy in particular has not yet even begun to contemplate. But for now, that answer your question? Probably more than you're looking for. But that's what my Rebbe always told me, give people more, not less. So, at what point are we going to give this codification a definitive structure and legal decisions? And what does this mean for the conversation? Now, we already know a little bit what the answer to Avram's question is, because did the codification of the Mishnah end the conversation? On the contrary, it evoked the conversation. And as everybody knows who's ever learned any Jewish text, as soon as you write a book, what happens? Yeah, commentary, and then there's commentary, and the commentary, and then, like, Jews got to make a living, so, like, the thing just grows. But it's more than that, because that's what an ongoing conversation is. Because if I started to speak to you in Shakespearean English right now, you wouldn't understand what I was speaking about. But if I put a play of Shakespeare up on the board, we can dissect it in our language and derive all kinds of meaning, both about what Shakespeare meant, what the culture he represented meant, what it means to us, how it might instruct us about how, you know, understand? So that every text offers this discourse. It's not unique to the Jewish endeavor. One can argue it's just that the continuity of our discourse is what makes it unique.
Every text and every law needs
constant application and interpretation, right? The world is always changing. So the challenge of codification is that you freeze an ongoing process at a certain point in history, which means you freeze it at a certain point in language, a certain point in culture, a certain point in, you know, the sociology of men, women. That's why I just pushed on the precision of language there, is that the point at which the Gemara got frozen, with the exception of Bruria, there were no women's voices in it. Does that mean that there was that women's voices don't belong there? You'll never know. I mean, you can pull all kinds of sources from the sages themselves to answer that question, but bottom line, you'll never know, because it didn't have a continuity of conversation that allowed the sociology around it to produce groups of learned women like we have today. So you just don't know, and therefore you don't know what it would produce. So, but just to finish the actual progress, we're going to peg, just like Abaye and Rava will give us the beginnings of these structures in the 4th century, we're going to peg, according to the Gemara, the what we call sof hora'ah. If you look in the Gemara in Bava Metzia, says Rebbe v'Rav Natan sof Mishnah. So Rebbe, meaning Rebbe Yehuda Nasi, and Rav Natan, who was contemporary, were the end of the Mishnah. Fine, that was a long time ago in our story. We're not going back there. Rav Ashi v'Ravena sof hora'ah. Now, Rav Ashi and Ravena are the end of hora'ah. And what hora'ah means is the big question. Because if you ask the average student of Jewish history who finished the Gemara, from a traditional perspective, they'll tell you Rav Ashi and Ravena. But if you actually begin to scrape away at it, it all depends on what that word hora'ah means. What does the word hora'ah mean? If you get a tudat hora'ah, what have you gotten? Education, teach, instruction. By the way, what other very important word to the Jews might be rooted there? Torah, right? Depending on what you think the origin of the word Torah is, right? Which is a very different perspective. Remember, that's the perspective of the Torah as an instruction manual, not an answer book. Right? It's supposed to teach you how to be, not tell you what to do. Those are two very different things. And the specific nature of hora'ah, however, of course, you also need answers. You can't just have an ongoing conversation with no conclusion. And so the question is Rav Ashi and Ravena, and it's a machloket between Rashi, the Rambam, and Rav Shreira Gaon. I'm not going to, you know, drag you through. You don't have to memorize who said what. But I want you to understand the different ways of looking at it. Is that according to Rashi, what Rav Ashi and Ravena did was give the definitive structure to the Gemara. They were the ones who decided this is in, that's out. This is the way that the conversation goes, and this is how the pieces fit together, right? Because he's operating on the assumption that it was never written down before that. And that whether it was because the perennial challenge of Jewish history, which is the people who know this knowledge are dying, or because of a sense that we just lack the ability to keep a live conversation, or because, as we say in modern Hebrew, chalas, let's just write the thing down, right? That what was given there was structure, according to Rashi.
Not just an oral structure, but a written structure.
Not clear. Once again, not clear. I mean, if you want to hear what Rashi says, is he says, the Arachshav, Hayu Talmidim, Golsim Shmua Shmua Levada, that students would learn each teaching on its own. And there weren't sort of like ordered tractates. Seder v'kovet al ha-seder, meaning you didn't have like now, there's a Mishnah and there's Gemara on the Mishnah. You had topics, right? But he doesn't ever use the phrase nichtavu, that they were written down. And I happen to, in my learning right now, I lean toward the side of oral text. It really seems that the evidence is strongly in favor up through the Gaonic periods. We're talking about through the 10th century. That the Gemara learned by the Gaonim in the academies was an oral text. And that's going to become very significant. I don't want to drift off into it now, but become very significant in our discussion of what happens between the Gaonic period and the Rishonim. But for now, Rashi says it was about the structure. Rav Shreira actually says, and to make it worse, by the way, there are two Ravenas, and it's not really sure, like one's in the sixth generation of Moraim, one's in the eighth generation. It's just a mess. But that's not a level of detail I need you to hold. What I need you to hold is that Rav Shreira says that, no, what happened was a chatima. A chatima is a sealing or a codification in our language, and it was of law. Meaning, as the Rambam says, after Rav Ashi's Beit Din, no one could pass laws anymore that were binding on all of Am Yisrael. That instead of just the structure of the Gemara, which will serve as the basis to ongoing conversation, so that's important, because we have this notion, remember, of the Yiridata Dorot, this descent of generations, that indeed, the further we get from Sinai, the less able we are to argue back. So therefore, if you can give me a definitive structure, I have to accept the terms of the discourse. Nevertheless, as we saw in the Gemara itself, halacha kibatrai, the actual decisions are according to the later authorities. So there's an undermining of that simplistic notion of the descent of generations that we've spoken about. But nevertheless, codification is a very strong act of authority in structure. But here the Rambam goes further. He says that if the rabbinic project is pushing toward a one-to-one identification between law and identity, and the ability to pass laws that are binding on all Jews ends with Rav Ashi, then what document now defines a Jew? The Gemara. You hear the equation? Because the Rambam, of course, lived in 12th early Eastern. Rather, I'm going to leave for a half hour. 11:35 to 12:04, right? So he's 500 years later. There have been plenty of Bate Din and, you know, courts that have been passing all kinds of laws, et cetera. But the Rambam just pointed out, be careful. You can pass local ordinances, right? It says the Rambam, can declare in my shul that we don't do the silent amida anymore, because I've noticed people just talk. So we're just going to do it out loud, and everyone's going to say amen, which is one of the things he actually instituted, right? But I can't say that's what the Jews do. You understand the difference? Whereas anything from Rav Ashi going back, I can say that's what the Jews do, and ipso facto, if you don't do it, you're not Jew. Right? And that's where the historical sociological oomph comes. I think the rest of it's very interesting, and I happen to like these studies, and learning Gemara is a lot of fun. But in terms of our arc of history, understand that the codification of the Gemara is the codification of an identity. The Gemara, once it's done in the hands of the Gaonim, as we'll discuss, becomes a cultural matrix. I can take this thing, plop it down, add water, and the Jews will emerge. And anybody who doesn't accept that is not a Jew. Who will be the big team that doesn't accept that? The Christians, anyway, we broke with them. We're going to come back to the story. It'll be the Karaites that really challenge this. Because ism and schism always come into the world together. Once you can give an ism, Judaism, you force the issue. Right? The other way to say that is that as long as there's such thing as heterodoxy, everyone's fine. Right? When heterodoxy becomes heresy, it's because you've created orthodoxy. Understand? Yes.
It seems to me that possibly, I mean, the Romans had a lot of stuff, they had the Institutes of Gaius and all kinds of things beforehand. Justinian comes along and said, we must have a complete
code. Yes.
So, looking at that from the Jewish point of view, I'd be thinking, well, you know, perhaps it's about time that we.
I think it's hard to deny that there's some, either you could say zeitgeist, we could say like the world over. Something shifting, as I said, law is becoming much more important. Or there could be a much more direct influence. There are people who argue, by the way, that the nature of the Gemara is reflective of a certain Roman literary style of the digest. Right? One of the things that confuses the modern reader about the Gemara is that it's law mixed with narrative, mixed with, you know, home remedies and news. Right? But it may be reflective of a Roman literary style of the time. So it wouldn't be surprising then if there was a direct. By the way, we'll also see that the Visigothic code, further away in the Roman Empire, over in the Iberian Peninsula, is a little bit later, but legitimately close enough to this to say there's some function of codification happening within what we'll call European, even though it's a bit of an anachronism, European society, Roman society, the Greco-Roman society. Yeah. Why is a little bit beyond my knowledge base. Fair enough, meaning the Bavli is happening in Babylon. I don't have so much knowledge of whether Babylon was undergoing the same legalization of culture. So it's a question. But what I can say for sure, there's a zeitgeist, meaning there is some multiple cultures that are seeing the need around the Mediterranean basin to get things straight. I want you to appreciate the power of codification now. Because it certainly doesn't end the conversation. The conversation, the very notion that the conversation ends is ludicrous, right? Why? Because even if you take the most traditionalist stance that every letter of the Gemara was given to Moshe at Sinai, which you may laugh, but I have heard stated with a serious face, right? Even so, the world constantly changes. There is no microwave, not in the Torah and not in the Gemara either. So therefore, no matter what sort of philosophical, theological construct you want to apply to, how you work it out of an unchanging law in a constantly changing world, the conversation can't cease. Otherwise, you know, all living systems, I'm willing to bet you guys have seen Annie Hall, right? How does Woody Allen define a relationship? A relationship is like a shark. Right? A shark has to keep moving to live, right? And when what we have on our hands here is a dead shark, that's what he says. So in the same way, like a people that ceases its conversation is over. It's done. Right? And so therefore, the conversation can't cease. However, what we get here And what's interesting to me is the definition of identity. Because now, either like Rashi said, this is our conversation, and if we don't share a common language, then we're not really the same people. On some level, that's a big challenge that the Jews between the diaspora and Israel are facing today. Right? And if it's like the Rambam and Rav Shrera, that what we're looking at here is the end of Hora'ah, the end of the ability to give abiding instruction for all of Am Yisrael, it means that, listen, what comes afterwards, the Spanish Jews might look at the Polish Jews and say, we don't do it this way, but they'll stay, we're both Jews. But as soon as you look at the Karaites and say, we don't do it this way, and the Karaites say, yes, we do, it's like, ooh, well, you're a Karaite, you know what the Karaites will call the other Jews? Rabbinites, right? Which people don't hear so much because who wins that contest, right? But trust me, in its day, there were Rabbinite Jews and Karaite Jews, and it was not so clear who was going to win. But that lies ahead in our story. For now, a convenient date for the end of the structure of the Gemara is going to be about around the year 500. That's usually the year you see, around 500. It's fine. It's a round number. It's helpful. I might even put it on your, between 5 and 6. I even gave you the reference of Bab Metzia there, so you can look it up later. Sof Hora'ah. There is, however, of course, another layer to the Gemara. Right? That layer of the Gemara, just to remind you guys what we've spoken about, right? We have the Mishnah, produced by the Tanaim, and we were defining them as teachers. We had the Gemara, right, produced by the Amoraim, and there are many generations there, as there were many generations of Tanaim, Amoraim. And I encourage you to think about them as speakers. Not that they're not teaching, but that, first of all, the word means, right, Amira is speaking, but also because the boundary of the conversations have essentially been set. So they're speaking out within that, right? The Amoraim have, as we said, then there's going to be some Chatima, some codification, but the editing doesn't end there. Because then the general understanding is that you will have the Savoraim, right? And a Svara is what? A thought, an idea, right? It's the Gemara. It's funny, I messed up the structure here, sorry. Savoraim. We're going to call that final edits, right? I'll say last thoughts. Now, those last thoughts can take all kinds of roles. You know, on one hand, if there was a codification and Rav Ashi and Ravina gave you, we don't make the rules anymore. So the Sforim are what gives the Bavli in particular. Sometimes it's sort of intricate sense of, if you've ever learned a sugi in the Bavli, which has led you around this wandering path, and suddenly, like, there's, like, at the end, especially if you have a good teacher who's able to, like, pull the thread, and, like, the whole thing just comes together, and you say, I can't believe that just happened. Like, we've been wandering around, like, for pages. Like, I mean, had no idea. It was, like, in the dark, and suddenly, like, many people believe the Savarim are ones who give the literary smoothness to that journey. Like, the structure was already beginning well back, but they were that last edit. So that's one element which they add. Another element which they add is that not every conversation in the Gemara reaches its conclusion. So oftentimes what's known as the voice of the Stama Gemara, these questions that will just come and say, well, like, what about this or what about that? Without conclusion, that will also be the Sevarim because it's the indication that just because you codify doesn't mean the conversation's over. Because the reality is this codification is a blanket term. There are plenty of conversations within the Gemara, and many of them are completely unfinished. And the question of how bound later authorities will be to the back and forth, right? The Gemara, if you've ever learned any of it, will almost exhaustively go back and forth about every point. And sometimes it does it, and you know what? It's not so clear what the conclusion was. It's maddening, right? It's like, come on, I just waded through all that, you're not even going to tell me the bottom line? So the question is, well, what does a later authority do in resolving it? What's called bayesh alo ifshita, a question that never actually gets answered. So that's another place where the Savorim may add a little bit of weight to the thought, but it's the final editing. It's, by the way, lacking from the Yerushalmi. As we spoke about, the Yerushalmi gets cut off generationally even before the stage of the codification of the Bavli. And so that's one of the reasons that scholars believe that Yerushalmi has these leaps, these literary leaps and gaps right? That it simply didn't have the same level of editing.
How many
Sepharim are usually that period between 500 and 600. That's like Professor Alivni puts them there. And you know, academics have a lot to say about this, and they bring very interesting tools to bear. For our learning, what you need to understand is that even though there was a formal recognition of an end of a process, even the literary structure of the Gemara continued to be edited. And I've seen in the Rishonim the recognition that it was even the Gonim, which is a later period, there was still a little bit of like massaging things into the Gemara, which bears some thought. Just to point out why that matters, is that if you have an oral text, what's definitive? Grammar or meaning? Meaning, like, I'm holding a structure of a sugya in my mind, and as I'm reviewing it in my mind, I realize, oh my gosh, I never realized that this is what this is about, right? If anybody's learned enough Gemara, you know you have the experience. First time you read it, you think you know what it's talking about. Second time you read it, you realize, gosh, I have no idea what this is about. The third time you read it, okay, maybe I'm getting some sense of what's going on. So you read it over and over and over again. Then one day, suddenly the light goes off and your reading completely shifts. And what happens to the syntactic structure in light of that? The human mind is not always such a disciplined tool. Sometimes what will happen is the structure will rearrange itself in your mind in reflection of your understanding, right? And this, by the way, is a very different relationship to text, right? That we're going to have to deal with when we get to the Gaonic period, once textual integrity becomes more and more definitive of Jewish life. Sadly, a lot of it in reaction to our struggle with the Christians, right? The greatest example I can give you of that is that the chapters of the Hebrew Bible do not become a part of our tradition until Christian-Jewish polemics. They're not organic to the Torah. Right? So that itself tells you that these structural elements may or may not be definitive for meaning. But that's a discussion I don't want to drift into. For right now, yeah. Yeah. Is codification the right term? What do you have an alternative? I mean, I can hear the question.
Because if we're thinking again of Palestinian or other things, then it's a logical thing. It's more like the round bound. It's more like codification than the short barrel.
Yes.
What we have in the country.
Yes. I would say that's probably the reason that Rav Shrera uses the word chatima. Now, we translate it as a codification because we lack a better term. Khatima just means the sealing of a process.
Yes.
It lacks the... Now, there are elements, like people pointed out, between what's in and what's out, what becomes a definitive opinion. There are those hallmarks within, but you're correct. The Shulchan Aruch and the Rambam are codes. Yes.
And after that final text, if you're not going to alter in the words, then you work out what in this final text will lead to the logical text.
I think it's a critical point you're making. And it's a limitation of language. I think perhaps you're right, and you know, Blinetta, but I'll try to say, let's call it the sealing of the Gemara. Right? I think it's a much better term because it's also a proper translation of Chatima. But the challenge you're pointing out is critical. The age of codification for the Jews comes later. It's definitive of the age of the Rishonim, and it deals with a shift in culture that we'll discuss. So I very much appreciate that. Let's call it the ceiling. Sorry, people wrote that down in pen, but it's a much better term. Yeah.
Is there also a relationship with the idea of canonization? Yeah.
Right, so canonization is a process that deals with authority, right? I would say yes, but. What do I mean yes, but? The canonization of the Hebrew Bible was a product of 600-700 year process where each individual text had already gained authority within different communities. It was really a question of consensus about what's in and what's out. The Gemara at this point isn't the text, except to the immediate sort of students who have gathered around it. So it's a canonization in the sense that, yes, here is the canon of the Gemara. We decide what's in, what's out. But the project of gaining authority is going to take much longer. You understand the distinction I'm making? Once the rabbis have a canonized text in the sense of this is the Gemara and that is not, now the canonical authority that we at least associate with the word canon, they're going to have to fight for.
So I was thinking more about just kind of normalizing a text, so rather than going right to authority, just saying at a certain point, most scholars,
yes,
in the Jewish people,
will say this is the text. Great. No, no, I think you're correct, but I'll just point out to you that you can't separate that from authority. Once you say this is the text, that is a tremendously authoritative statement. Even if I make it as an objectively academic statement of like, well, no, this is the proper text and that is not. If there are two texts there, and I say this, yes, that, no, that is a huge assertion of authority. Meaning, what caused this to be the sealing of the Gemara? So that leads us on to the next piece. We're never going to get to Christianity, are we? Well, we'll get. I mean, they're not going away. So first of all, I am a believer that there's no such thing as an intellectual process which can be divorced from its historical and sociological context. Like, I don't believe in that. I don't think that every intellectual process is solely a product of that. I do believe that the human spirit is more than that, but nevertheless, the two, in my eyes, can't be separated. So the question was this sealing just a coincidence of its own, I wouldn't say coincidence, a product of its own internal process, right? Was it sort of like, at a certain point, the rabbis all looked around and said, okay, we got it. Like, let's stop here? Or was there also a social historical context which sort of militated in favor of that? So one is, I think, yes, there is a point at which a conversation has been chewed over enough that you say, we're done. So I think that's an important piece here. The other I'm searching for in my notes. Here we go. Ha ha. That's why I put it off to the corner, so I wouldn't know where it was. So you know, as much as I presented, and it's often presented, that life in Bavel was good, life under the Romans was bad, and it's not an unfair statement. Nevertheless, there were a couple of periods of difficulty for the Jews under Babylonian rule. Interestingly enough, Hanukkah is coming up. So if you look in the Gemara in Shabbat on the sugyot of my Hanukkah, you'll see there's a halacha to this day that you're allowed to light your candles inside the house. And the Gemara asks why, since the whole purpose of lighting candles is what? What's the purpose, though? Right, presume Nisa, so like you want to advertise the world. So we have to come up with some explanation of how inside your house, but why would we let you do that? So one of the answers is given is because it's not safe. And Rashi there says, why wouldn't it safe? Because the non-Jews, the Nochrim, will see the fire and they'll get angry. Now most people read that in light of Christian persecution, which is like, oh, they'll know you're a Jew, they're coming for you. Which, by the way, they knew you were a Jew before you lit the candles in your window. All right, so it doesn't work. What Rashi is referring to is a period of what's known as the Mazdaist period. No, not the car, although it's not really funny anymore. We don't have the Mazda dealer here anymore, but it used to be a great joke. There was a period of radical Zoroastrian reorganization of the Persian Empire. In the year 495, Marzutra II was the Resh Galuta. He was the head of the exile. We haven't spoken so much about the institution of Resh Galuta. We're not going to do it now. We'll talk about it in context of the Gaonim. But he was just the head of the exile, just like there was a Nasi, a head of the Sanhedrin in the land of Israel, up until 425. So too, in Bavel, there was a head, big Jew. He was the Resh Galuta. He shows up in the Gemara as a character. We'll continue. It's an institution that returns in the time of the Gaonim under the Muslims. They were very big into it. So Marzutra was the Resh Galuta, who under Sasanian rule, that was the particular subset of the Zoroastrians at the time, led a revolt in 495 and actually had 7 years of political independence around Mechoza, right, which is the location of Sur, right on the banks of the Euphrates. There was a Jewish, you can call it a commonwealth, you can call it a bandit state, depends on which side of the story you're telling, rebellion. And what was it because of Zoroastrian persecution. One of the things, by the way, the Zoroastrians held to be sacred was fire. So that's, by according at least to Professor Goffney, that's the reference that Rashi's making, that the Zoroastrians, this fire was sacred. So you can't just be showing fire in your windows, like fire belongs to us. And this, anyway, a much longer discussion that we're not going to have, but it's worth looking at Professor Goffney's writings about how much influence Zoroastrian culture has on the Gemara. Right? How much, because you know, a lot of the Gemara is folk culture. If you ever notice, this amazing quote by, ooh, it might have been Chernikovsky, one of the early Zionist writers, whose frustration with the Hebrew language was, I have a complex demonology and angelology, and I don't have words for the trees in the forest around me. Meaning he inherited a culture from Babel, where the language was reflected of Zoroastrian folk culture. If you've ever looked in the Gemara, demons, angels, like, you know, all kinds of, like, magic formulae, this is, like, all over the place. And there's live discussion now among scholars. How much was it the Jews influencing the Zoroastrians? How much did the Zoroastrians influence the Jews? Anybody ever use a gartel when they pray here? Anybody put on a gartel when you pray? You know what I'm talking about? It's like a belt you take out. And the Shulchan Aruch says, by the way, ein libo roet erto, or your heart shouldn't see your private places. Many scholars say, well, that's a very clear Zoroastrian tradition, because they were the dualists who held that the certain organs of the body were divine, basically from the diaphragm upwards, right? And the other organs of the body, digestion and excretion, are, you know, the sort of like the lower, and that you should separate them, right? So that's like a minor point, but the point I'm making is that there was a fusion of culture, and there's some deep questions about how much of the culture of the Gemara is reflective of a purely Jewish culture, and how much of it is reflective of the cultural melange in which they found themselves. And you can understand why this is a much larger discourse. Right? Today, people like to talk about Jewish values. In America, Jewish values, right? And I see with my students all the time, they say, well, that's not the expression of my Jewish values. Often certain things that they find challenging in an ethnic nation state like Israel. It's not my Jewish values. I always say to them, that's great. Is it your American values or your Jewish values you're talking about? Is it your liberal Western values? Is there such a thing as Jewish values, separate from the culture within which it finds itself? How do we identify such a thing? Right? If I can say that the Maccabees did it this way, does that make it a Jewish value? Well, they became Hellenists in the end, right? And the Bible, we're going to go with the Bible, except, of course, what was the number one challenge of biblical Israel? Idolatry. So it's a bit of a challenge to assert that there is this thing at the same time. Law, we can at least put our finger on. You understand? I can say the Gemara says you're supposed to put a belt on before you pray. And all the scholarly question of what the origin of that is may be interesting, maybe not. But remember, what was the rabbinic project? That one-to-one identification between law and identity. So I can say for sure the Jews do this. Is it a Jewish thing to do? Well, you see how this begins to work circularly. Especially when the Zoroastrians, well, I mean, they're actually still around, but as a world culture, are not so dominant anymore. And the Jews are still alive and kicking. I don't know how many Zoroastrians put on a gartel before they pray, but I know a lot of Jews who do.
I would say the indicator is a tremendous influence of Zoroastrianism on the Jews. It's the, you know, what does it say, that the Torah was written in Moras, filled with all these images that are reflective of Zoroastrianism.
Yeah, listen. This notion of the isolation of the Jews is something we're going to come back to. Because even in Christian Europe, it's largely a myth until early modernity and an actual building of ghetto walls. Even in Christian Europe, where most Jews think of like it was us and them, for most of the history of Christian Europe, Jews lived in small scattered settlements amongst the Christians. And by the way, the parallel to the Gemara in that respect is if you've ever read Sefer Chassidim. We'll get to it when we talk about it. But Sefer Chassidim is the exact parallel. It is Christian folk culture for Jewish consumption. Or Christian folk culture itself was a product of Jewish culture. Don't discount who's the influencer and who's the influenced then. Now, our relationship with the Zoroastrian culture goes way back. And the Jews do have a certain element of dualistic thinking. We're willing to recognize the existence of evil. We attribute it all to God, but God has multiple names. Right, this whole Satan character that pops up every once in a while in our tradition, like I say the Yetzer Hara, like there's all kinds of elements. So it's really hard to know Again, scholars do real work on these things, and they're fascinating. But my point in bringing this was an answer to your question of you is that there was a earth-shaking shift in the relationship between institutional Jewry and Jewish culture and the surrounding Persian culture right in 495 is more or less exactly when we said this was happening. Now, it's hard to imagine that the two didn't have something to do with each other. Because, by the way, this rebellion lasted for 7 years. And then it was broken in 502, right? When the king defeated Marzutra, crucified him on the bridge of Machoza, right? His son was born, of course, on the day of his death. Remember, we spoke about this phenomenon, right? That Rabbi Yehuda Anasi was born on the day that Rabbi Akiva died. And this sense that God doesn't leave Am Yisrael without leadership, but sometimes it's Kehutasara, right, that they come pretty tight together. His son's name Marzutra III, and we're going to come back to him because the tradition is that they smuggled him out back to the land of Israel, to Tveria, which was up in the north, the last stronghold of sort of Jewish culture there, and that he stays there and that he becomes what's called Reish Pirka, right, the head of the teachings. For several generations, his descendants will stay there, and there are many people that believe that the later tradition of the Masoretes will have its roots in his line. If you don't know what I'm talking about, that's fine. We're going to come to the Masoretic tradition and what was going on there in Tveria in the 9th and 10th centuries. But I've got 5 minutes left. So I want to wrap this up and get your questions. We're going to pick up with Christianity next week, okay? It's going to go back a little bit, but poor Deborah, she keeps printing this stuff off for me and I never use it. I feel bad. Okay. So in brief, I like the correction. We're dealing with the sealing of a process and not its codification, right? Even though it has elements of the codification in the sense that there's a solid text we're going to point to, there's questions of how much of it is canonical. And I want to just emphasize that don't ask questions on history from Judaism, meaning Judaism is still in process at this point. It's made a big leap with the Gemara. Because like the Rambam says, once you have an end to the definitive legal process that can be sort of said to be obligatory on everyone, then if you do what's in the Gemara, you're a Jew. If you don't, then you're not. Nevertheless, there are still a lot of work to be done. There are Jews scattered all over the Mediterranean basin, North Africa, the remnants of the Roman Empire. We haven't even talked about what's happening in Rome. And most of them have never heard of the rabbis. They've not heard of them. And if they've heard of them, and the evidence we have for this, by the way, is in synagogue inscriptions. It's where they look. And when do synagogue inscriptions move from Greek and local languages to Hebrew, which tends to be the marker archaeologists are looking for when rabbinic culture really definitively took over. And that starts to happen around the 5th, 6th century, if you look when we're speaking about. Right? And when do we achieve this Judaism, which is a one-to-one relationship of identity between law and identity? But what a Jew is what a Jew does, and what a Jew does is what the Gemara says. So that needs this period of sealing, but it will also take another several generations. And don't forget, what lies on the horizon is that with the ism comes the schism. It was not for nothing that the Karaitic rebellion is bound up with the establishment of the Gaonet and a definitive thing that you can look at and call Judaism. So we have 2 minutes left. Are there questions or comments? People want clarifications before we go. Jew born from a Jewish mother. Well, if you ask the sages, it's a pasuk. Yes. He sort of sociologically, when's it established? I have not seen anyone able to pin that down. It obviously matters a lot. Although, don't forget, the most obvious sociological reason for that is that you always know who a person's mother is. So on some level, you can imagine it would always work that way. The question is the opposite. At what point does a woman no longer definitively become part of the dominant Jewish culture just by marrying a Jewish man? Mm-hmm. Right? I think it's really a question in the process of conversion, as opposed to, right? Because in Islam today, a woman that marries a Muslim man becomes a Muslim. So therefore, there's no such problem as we have in terms of the children, non-Jewish children. I suspect that such was the case when we were also a dominant culture. But it's hard to identify in time.
Say the question again. Where
to Islam. So we will spend plenty of time talking about the advent of Islam and its impact on Judaism. I'm not going to answer that in the last 2 minutes of class. Okay, I think that we're going to stop there. Thanks, everybody, for their hard work, and we'll pick up next.
Thank you for downloading this podcast from the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies. For more original Torah content, visit almad.pardes.org.